This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. This afternoon, I'm going to be talking with two authors who have a connection with Nevada County, in some cases a very deep one, and a connection specifically with the San Juan Ridge. In the first half of the program, I'm going to be talking to Robert Tindall, who has recently published The Jaguar That Roams the Mind, an Amazonian Plant Spirit Odyssey. As you heard a little while ago, he and his wife, Susanna Bustos, will be appearing at the North Columbia Schoolhouse Cultural Center this Saturday at 7:30 p.m., and we'll tell you more about that a little later on in the program and probably hear some from Robert himself. He writes in The Jaguar That Roams the Mind of his experiences, his spiritual experiences, a number of places in the world, but especially in the Amazon Basin, and especially with use of the compound plant psychotropic substance, I guess to be most precise, ayahuasca. In the second half of the program, I'm going to be talking with a longtime North San Juan or San Juan Ridge resident, Sylvia Anderson, who's published recently a book called Symbolia, which is she calls a children's or a story for children of all ages. It's a allegorical journey into another world with two young children who experience just about everything that can go right or wrong in our world, in this other world, and then come back to deal with the place they left. But first, Robert Tindall, welcome to Booktown.
Thank you.
The book, The Jaguar That Roams the Mind, really takes place. It covers about 2 years of events around, I'm guessing, 2003, 2004, 2005.
Yes.
And it starts with your experiences in one of the driest places in the world and winds up in one of the wettest.
Right.
You start in the Sahara and then you go to the Amazon.
Yes.
How did you make this transition? What did it mean for you?
Well, that's as winding a story as I think you could have. I had gone to Morocco in pursuit of another book project entirely. I was wanting to, and still am, wanting to write about the Children's Crusade and a very interesting outcome to it that happened in 1208, and I had gone through France and down into Morocco in the hopes that I would be able to pick up the trail of the protagonist of the Children's Crusade, Stéphane de Croix. And I kind of ended up sidetracked into a completely other sort of pursuit in terms of literarily, but at the same time, it's all coming full circle now as well. And in the desert, I had a kind of literary epiphany or an inspiration that if I really wanted to get to the bottom of the questions I was interested in, I needed to get to the Amazon. And in particular, I had heard stories about plant medicines and how they worked. I went. I ended up going. Like, there was a confluence of various events that carried me down there.
And you started out in Brazil and then wound up in Peru.
Yes, and that was after I met my wife, Susanna, who's also going to be presenting with me on Saturday. And we ended up traveling together and going deep into the jungle, really living without electricity and outside contact. The election happened in 2004, and we didn't know who'd won. And there we ended up in what became the beginning stages of an apprenticeship with an Ashaninka healer. And I should say that an apprenticeship is really about a 20-year process. So when I say the beginnings, I really mean that. But what we did end up doing was immersing ourselves into the indigenous cosmology of the Amazonian people. And it unfolded for us in stages. And it's kind of that account of the unfolding of that world and the adventures as it happened for both of us. Though, of course, it's from my perspective that I give an account of in The Jaguar. And kind of like the other woman's book that you mentioned at the beginning, it's essentially a there and back tale, journey into the other world and a coming back into this one.
Now, you didn't start out, since we've mentioned Symbolia, it's about two young children who really know almost nothing before they begin their adventures. You started out with a huge wealth of spiritual background. You've been involved in Zen, studied various Hindu disciplines, I think, as well, Aikido.
Yeah. And well, that's very complimentary, but I'm not sure I merit it.
Oh. And you also had a lot of...
I've been practicing a ring of bone up on the ridge for many years, the Zendo that Gary Snyder kindly founded for us. But I think that it really does come in as a serious benefit to have had a spiritual discipline that you've been grounded in when you work with entheogenic plants, for sure, because they're really hard to integrate in your daily life.
You also have a pretty strong literary background, and you have references to Greek mythology, to many poets, to a lot of actual popular fiction, like The Lord of the Rings, to movies like The Matrix. You bring just about everything you can to bear on your experiences. And it struck me when you spoke of the Amazonian cosmology, the first experience you had in Brazil was an amalgam. The experiences were about the entheogens, the actual plant powers, but they were incorporated into a cosmology that was partly native Amazonian, partly African, partly Spanish Christian, and probably a couple of other elements as well. In Peru, it wasn't quite so complicated, but the people you worked with were quite willing to talk about Jesus, for instance, and the Catholic saints as being involved with the plant medicine that they practice.
Yes. The Peruvian tradition that we were in is really mestizo de Hitalismo, which arose when mixed blood workers, forest workers, and people living on the margins of the forests began to apprentice themselves to the shamans of the deep jungle. And, of course, now there are very few shamans of the deep jungle practicing in the traditional way. And so even for our own maestro, Juan Flores, who is an Ashaninka Indian, his name is Spanish, and he primarily speaks in Spanish. And he's there's a kind of liberal Catholic cosmology that you encounter with the mestizo population in the Amazon, which incorporates everything from the Virgin Mary. Our teacher sung Icaros, or the sacred songs that Susanna will be talking about in depth on Saturday night, to the Buddha, to Krishna. But as well, the thing that really distinguishes this medicine is they're deeply in contact with the spirits of the land itself. And so in Amazonian experience, The trees have healing intelligences. The rivers are alive. There's a way that the living vegetable animal world penetrates with the world of spirits. And so you could have a ceremony where the boa constrictor is being sung to enter into someone's body and clean it out at the same time that the Virgin Mary and Jesus Christ are guarding the portals of the experience. It sounds a little peculiar from the outside, but when you're in it, it makes a lot of sense.
And there was actually a third type of experience you had in a school or an institute, more urban, that was specifically using ayahuasca to cure people, other sorts of drug addictions.
Yes, that was Takahuasi, which is, it's actually also very strongly based in the Vegetalismo tradition of Peru. But that was founded by a doctor named Jacques Mabi. He's French, and he founded it some years ago after he had begun investigations into indigenous methods of healing, and he received a vocation to work with drug addicts. And so at Takahuasi, they're combining Western medicine and psychology with indigenous methods of healing. And it's very effective, and it's not only Takahuasi that has demonstrated the efficacy of this approach. You can find it in the Native American church with their usage of peyote, or among the healers of the Andes in Peru, which work with San Pedro.
Now, the one sort of common theme through the three sets of experiences you had in Brazil at Takahuasi, and then finally in the jungle, is ayahuasca, this vine of the dead. Mm-hmm. But when you got to the jungle, you found that there were dozens, maybe hundreds of other plants that were involved in your discipline.
Mm-hmm. That's true, and yet ayahuasca is kind of the linchpin around which much Amazonian practice revolves. Also tobacco, the organic black tobacco, which is much higher in nicotine content, is also extremely important down in the Amazon and is used as a medicine quite deliberately. And what we ended up formulating is that Amazonian medicine has three pillars, and one of those is dieting, which is really pretty much fasting, where you cut your diet to what can be as basic as eating just roasted green bananas for a month, which removes, obviously, a lot of distractions in order to be able to commune with the plant medicines that you are taking. Now, the second pillar is the practice of working with these medicinal plants, these teacher plants, and that involves purging. Now, Amazonian medicine sees that you have to have a clean body in order for the other plants to be effective on you. And at Takahuasi, they especially use purging in order to get the toxins out of the body. This is something the West doesn't do, but if you grow up in a jungle environment where there's a lot of parasites, you're often going to have to take purges in order to keep yourself clean anyways. So the whole thing really begins to make sense when you're in a center for the treatment of drug addiction and you hear about a patient who, in taking a purge, vomited up the codeine-laced cough syrup that he drunk 20 years before and which remained in his system and formed the basis of his addiction. So they have a whole art of purging, and many different kinds of plants that are used for different kinds of organs in the body or psycho-spiritual conditions that they want to address. Now, the third one, the third pillar, is work with ayahuasca, and that's really a unique category, because what I ended up seeing ayahuasca as is a catalyzer. Ayahuasca speeds up processes. It brings them together. It brings insight from outside of the bounds of the ego and the habitual self in really remarkable ways when it's managed properly. And this was the other thing we really got while we were down there, is if you are going to work with ayahuasca or other plant medicines, these are not recreational substances. You can take them recreationally, and they probably won't harm you. But the question of how much benefit you're going to derive besides having an experience is an open one. But when you work with the actual curanderos and you begin to appreciate their art, you really see how profoundly into issues of healing and really like well-being this work can reach. It's such an unmapped territory right now.
Now, you had a history of addiction, but you have not been addicted for years, but you still went to Takawasi before you actually went in to work with Juan Flores in the jungle.
Well, that happened sort of serendipitously. I hadn't gone there for treatment. I'd gone there following my new love, Susanna, who was going there in order to study the songs that the shamans were using in ayahuasca ceremonies, but really specifically how a patient experienced healing when they fell into the orbit of these songs. And again, she'll talk about this Saturday. It turned out to be a really fascinating study that went from the proposed 6 months to a full year, and in directions we hadn't expected it would go. So it's quite an adventure. But when I arrived at Takawasi, no, I didn't think I was going there for treatment. But because of my own history of substance abuse, I really had some things to reckon with.
And you mostly got them out of the way in that location, although there were a few things that hung on much longer.
Well, you know, they say that when you've been a drug addict, you've got that structure.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't deny that wisdom.
Now, you mentioned a minute ago that the three pillars of Amazonian medicine, you also just mentioned the singing, the Ikaros, mm-hmm. Which your wife was specifically studying, perhaps because of her studies or perhaps because they really are so important. They come up again and again and again, and you quote quite a few. Would you consider them really a fourth pillar, or was that just maybe in the practices that you were working with?
That's a really good question. I think the Ikaros are actually what weave it all together. Ikaros are sung throughout daily life in the Amazon. When you purge, an Ikaro will be sung over the medicine that you take. The tobacco that's blown on you, they'll still sing an Ikaro while they do it. When you diet, it's common for people to receive Ikaros from the spirits. And what the Ikaros are the energetic imprints of the plant spirit that you're working with. So in their cosmology, each plant is simultaneously a spirit, which is sentient and has healing capacities. They also, of course, have the capacity to inflict damage on people. So there's a lot of witchcraft going on in Peru, too. And I give an account in our book of how we waded through that at a certain point. But the Ikaros are sort of like, they're as pervasive as some like cell phone transmissions down in the jungle, especially in the traditional cultures. And I have to think about that some more. I'm really not sure.
Okay.
But it's key. They're so, the the sacred song, the mediating of the powers of the plants and spirits through the shaman's voice is so key to this whole endeavor.
Now, in her brief appendix in the book, your wife Susanna says that the songs at first sometimes seem not very impressive. They're very similar, and there's a lot of repetition, but that after a while you realize that each time it's being sung, it's subtly different to fit the particular plant and to fit the, she says, client, the person it's being sung for.
Yes. Yeah, that kind of blew our minds when she did the musical analysis and realized this. The shaman, Juan Flores, we did many recordings on the site. And so when she was analyzing the different versions of the songs, it was quite a discovery to realize that Juan was modulating constantly and creating variations that, according to Susanna and other anthropologists that have theorized on this, they think that they do this in order to bypass the conscious mind, which would notice the variation going on, and instead to sing directly to the body or to some aspect of the capacity for self-healing, the physis that I think that is what is called in ancient Greek medicine. But if you bypass the conscious mind that way and are able to connect with the deeper organic intelligence of the organism. But the right person to ask about that question would be Susanna.
And is she going to have recordings Saturday night?
We will have recordings. Hopefully we'll even have the CDs prepared for sale.
Great. Now the other topic that comes through, that runs through the whole book, and this is only natural because it's the title, is the jaguar that roams the mind. And you first experienced jaguar spirits, helpers, allies, whatever you want to call them, toward the very beginning of your time in the Amazon, and you had cat influences of one sort or another all the way through the whole process.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little more about that? And how does the jaguar roam your mind?
Well, I think that one of the trajectories that ayahuasca takes you along when you do deep work with it is you begin finding your commonality with other species. And it's a very common experience for people to have a very powerful encounter with the spirit of the jaguar. And, you know, an Amazonian experience, you can't really separate the spirit from the actual critter. Sometimes it goes together with an encounter with the animal. Other times not. And part of the mystery for me that I've been working on since I returned is when Westerners go into this other cosmology, or even they may drink the plant medicine here in the West and suddenly have an intense experience of some Amazonian form of life coming to them, for example, a boa constrictor or a jaguar, what does this mean in the context of the Western psyche? When I first experienced becoming a jaguar and kind of like discovering the jaguar within, it was incredibly empowering in ways of unlocking energy and vitality and capacity in me. But I didn't know what to make out of it. And I didn't end up being a jaguar shaman, as, gee, I thought maybe this is what's happening. But I did begin to understand that Amazonian medicine works in Westerners' lives in its own unique way. And it's really the catalyzing power that is so important with this.
Okay, we only have a couple more minutes, but there's two
sure.
important topics that we haven't touched on yet. One is the fact that we all hear about the destruction of the Amazon for timber harvesting or for oil or gas exploration. And it turns out that this was happening right next to the area where you were having your most profound experiences. Mm-hmm. What's going on? I mean,
The Amazon is under siege. And if folks think that the Indian killing is over, you're quite mistaken. I suggest you go for more information to Amazon Watch or the Amazon Conservation Team of Mark Plotkin. Right now there's a suit in the Ecuadorian court against Chevron for damages of $38 billion for the way that Texaco over 20 years contaminated vast swaths of Amazonian indigenous rainforest in the north of the country. They essentially committed genocide on many tribes and left behind an ecological catastrophe that dwarfs the Exxon Valdez. I'm really not exaggerating about this. And everyone is closely watching what the decision on this is going to be. And, of course, Chevron is, will kill in order to not have to pay this $38 billion. Essentially, the Amazon rainforest is at the brink of collapse. And if we continue exploiting it in the numerous ways that we are, it may be gone within 40 years. This is according to scientists. I think that answers your question.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, I think it does.
Yeah, it's quite... It's really when you get there and you really start discovering this and what a persistent cover-up there is of this in the media, it's quite appalling.
And the other question, a lot of people have proposed ecotourism as an alternative to exploiting the actual resources of rainforests like the Amazon. You have a couple of mildly disparaging comments about ayahuasca tourists, but you will be leading a group yourself this summer, and you say on your website that this is the topic that you've gotten perhaps most response to, this whole question of ayahuasca tourism.
Yes, it's a fine line. There is ayahuasca tourism, of course, and it even occurs in quite gross forms. And there are also healers that are working down there legitimately. The issue is finding your way to a legitimate healer. There are many businessmen who suddenly set themselves up as shamans and are serving plant brews that are actually quite dangerous because they're mixing the deadly nightshade family, Datura, into these brews to make sure that the client gets the high that they came down for. And for myself, the best that I've been able to work this out, and I've spent some time examining my own motivations, I think that in some way, when we get involved in this work, we're all ayahuasca tourists. But an awareness of the context of the medicine, and I think really a veneration for work with the plants, and a commitment to cultural survival on the part of indigenous people, is a really good guide to help all of us finding our way through so that we commit the least harm and bring the most benefit here. We do need to be really careful. There are reports that the Amazon vine is being over-harvested right now in the Amazon, and if ayahuasca becomes the next thing, which it's looking like it's becoming, but we don't take care of its sustainability, we're going to exhaust it. And that would be a real shame.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking with Robert Tyndall, author of The Jaguar That Roams the Mind. He and his wife, Susanna Bustos, will be at the North Columbia Schoolhouse Cultural Center this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. That's Saturday, March the 7th. And they'll be talking about encompassing the Amazon, ayahuasca, vegetalismo, and cultural survival. You'll get to hear a lot more of what we've been talking about today. You can also go to his website, roamingthemind.com, to find out more. If you want more information about the appearance at the schoolhouse, you can call 265-2826. Thanks so much for being with us, Robert.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
And I'll be back in a short time with Sylvia Anderson. I have with me now another San Juan Ridge longtime resident, Sylvia Anderson, who has published last fall a book called Symbolia, which I think she describes on her website as a children's book for all ages. Welcome to Booktown.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here, Eric.
In the book we've just been discussing, in Robert Tyndall's The Jaguar That Roams the Mind, he mentions a couple of times the importance in his early life of the book, The Phantom Tollbooth, which is a story of a boy who goes through a tollbooth and is suddenly in another world, very much like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, or The Wizard of Oz, or a number of other similar transformations. Yours is very similar also. The two children, Luke and Lucy, or I guess we should say Lucy and Luke, go through a cave near the area they visit their grandmother in the Sierras, and they're suddenly in the land of Symbolia.
Right. I was much influenced by the books that you mentioned also, but I wanted to write one that had a little bit more of the new paradigm in it than, say, the C.S. Lewis Narnia stories. So I've been working on it for a long time, and I finally got it published.
Yeah, and actually one of the quotes on the back says, Symbolia weaves together three stories. One is a mythical modern Hansel and Gretel fairy tale. One is a political spoof commenting on real life. And the third is native teachings. It blends the latest scientific findings with day-to-day life, encouraging positive action on all levels of being. Since you had that printed on the back of the book, I guess you agree?
Oh, yeah. That was a comment made by a person up here on the ridge that read the book.
Now, the political spoof gets pretty wild at times. Everybody has a strange, well, I shouldn't say everybody. Luke and Lucy have ordinary names. There is through the book, other people join them, mostly other children. They form almost like a children's crusade, if we want to go back to what Robert was talking about. And some of them have ordinary names, but most of them are Percy, who we find out his first full name is Perseverance.
Yes.
And Digger is Digger McBummer. McBummer, that's it, whose parents are totally bummed out by everything and just see the dim side of everything, but she wants to go on and find out what's out there in the bigger world.
Yeah, she wants to dig for the gold of self-understanding.
And so some of these places, the names, I will just look at the map on the front. I should say that Symbolia is an island. It's surrounded by... Now, the four quarters, I couldn't quite tell if these specifically referred to the land, the sea, or just the directions. There's Winterwise to the north, Everdawn to the east, Bountiful to the south, and Land of Looks Within to the west.
Yeah. Now, that was based on Native American four directions. But then I have a couple of other belief systems that I superimposed on top of them. I believe that they were talking about the same continuum, but dividing it up into different size pie slices. You know, the Native Americans did their main four directions. And then another system that I felt applied was the Michael Teaching's soul ages, where they come up with five basic soul ages that incarnate frequently on this plane, baby soul, infant soul, starting infant soul, baby soul, young soul, mature soul, and old soul. And then they have the transcendental soul and infinite soul that only come through once in a while when we really need them. But I felt that was talking about the same continuum that the Native American Four Directions was talking about. So I sort of overlaid that on the Four Directions. And then another, Graves Value System is another one that I thought was talking about the same continuum, which is actually a spiral. But he has seven value systems, and then when you get to eight, it's a repeat of one at a higher level in the spiral. And so I sort of tacked those all together, and there were certain places where they obviously relate, like the Native American concept of the West being the land of looks within. So that's your inner work, and that's a mature soul in the Michael teachings, where you're disillusioned with the young soul, mainstream, materialistic, imperialistic stuff, and you start to go within and question your own motives and stuff like that. And then in the Claire Graves value systems, that would be, I think, what he would call number five, which is when you start doing your inner work and you're disillusioned by the shallowness of materialism. So anyhow, all these systems, in my mind, fit on top of each other, and then I added my own understanding of the spiritual path and made a kid's story out of it that I hope is fun for the grown-ups, too.
Now, if you look at the map again, it's almost like the geographical areas in Pilgrim's Progress. You've got the jungle of womb, the mother lung rainforest, the meadows of May, giant's bathtub, the Gulf of Simon Says, the city of Cruel, and so on. And these are all allegorical places that the children go through.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it was interesting to hear Robert talking in the last half hour about all the stuff that's going on in the Amazon, you know, and that's the mother lung rainforest, you know, and the indie giants are causing all sorts of trouble there these days.
And I'm trying to think, indie is short for...
Giants of industry.
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 That's right.
Indie giants for short. We know them.
Yeah. There are so many new names in here, I can't remember them all. The equivalent of gasoline is...
Zarawa.
And the people who use it are the Zarhogs.
The Zarhogs, yes. Well, those are the cars, the vehicles are the Zarhogs. Used by the more stuffians, mostly.
Now, as they go along, they start picking up. They're not followers, because the people who go along with them are the ones who really know the area best. But in a sense, they are the followers, because when, at the very beginning, after Lucy and Luke arrive at Mount Vision, which I guess most of the people in Symbolia have never been able to go to the top, but they have.
Uh-huh. They don't even believe it, and a lot of people.
Yeah. And then they reach a group of the people who are called the Abos,
mm-hmm.
Which I assume is like Aboriginals.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a song sung which says that these are the two children who will set everything right.
Yeah, the two children from another world are going to come and bring the indie giants to their knees. and they think that Luke and Lucy are those two children. But Luke and Lucy aren't so sure it's really them. They have to go through a few more changes.
And along the way, most of the other kids who join with them have never heard this song, but they join with them for various reasons.
Uh-huh. Yeah, some of them come along with them immediately, and others catch up with them later. On the trip, for their own personal reasons, they decide to go on the sacred path. See, the kids have to follow the sacred path to get back home.
Right, and they don't know how many days it will take, but the eagle has told them at the very beginning that they will make it home in time for dinner.
Right.
If they stay on the path. If they don't, then all bets are off.
Right. And we all wander off the path once in a while and take a detour here and there, but then hopefully get back on again.
And at the very beginning, where they come to, not at the very beginning, but pretty close, they're the city-states of do this and the city-state of do that.
Yes.
And
at the Gulf of Simon Says.
And
the dictators?
The dictator, one of the dictators, manages to temporarily seduce Luke into thinking he can become a powerful member of his of his land, but that doesn't last very long.
No, but he does get to go on one spying expedition where he learns what's going on with the Indy Giants and with the dictators and the Indy Giants' involvement in it and many things, but he also learns that he doesn't want to be Mad Ham's number one assistant anymore.
Yeah. Yet it started out with Luke more or less representing the intellectual side and Lucy maybe more the artistic side.
Right.
They're always getting on each other's cases because he likes math and he likes things to be very orderly and she likes to wander around and get lost.
Yes, and she believes in magic a little more than he does at the beginning. And
And you could say that they represent sides of the brain, or you could say they represent the gender differences. And then later on, there's a creature, Flash, who says specifically that he represents the side of Luke's brain that he had once enjoyed, but that he'd neglected after he began being praised for his rationality.
Right. Right. That's the monster that Luke meets in the maze, in Shadow's underground maze.
But Flash says he's, I'm trying to remember the exact words, that there's the straight part of the mind and his is the part that sort of swirls and swivels,
yeah,
something
not
like
linear.
That.
Yeah, it more goes in waves. And I forget the wording I used at that point, too.
There are,
I'm talking about my own stuff.
Yeah, there are. Well, you're not the only one. I've talked with somebody about 2 months ago who had to ask me. He said, "You just read the book. Can you tell me what I said in this section?"
Oh, well, that's good. I'm glad I'm not.
I think the only people who really have their books down cold are the ones who do long author tours, or who get used to talking again and again and again about the material. After a while, they know it well. Besides the more allegorical names, there's things like the Lawrence Liverless National Labs, which is just an out-and-out pun.
Right.
and things like that. Did you... You said you've been working on this for 25 years.
More like 37 or something like that. Well, I started when my kids were young, and now they're adults and parents themselves, and my grandkids are starting to grow up. So
right,
I'm
now actually I say...
finish it.
You say now I'm a 76-year-old grandmother. I started writing this book 37 years ago, But I guess you've been 25 years you've lived on the ridge. Or is it longer than that?
Yeah, well, I first moved here in, 1969, I think, to live at Ananda. And then left Ananda, but liked the ridge and stayed around for a while. And then I went to live on the farm in Tennessee. I don't know if you've heard of Stephen Gaskin's farm in Tennessee.
Anyone my age would have to have.
Yeah. And I lived on the farm for 12 years and went through many changes and learned a lot of stuff there and met a lot of wonderful people. And then the farm system changed and it no longer satisfied my ideals. And so I left and ended up back on the ridge again. And I'm really grateful to be here.
And most of the quotes on the back are all from ridge students and also ridge adults.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a very close connection.
Yes, I have a whole lot of friends here, a big extended family. And I tried the book out on a couple of my, a couple kids of my friends, two different families, two kids in each family, and they would come and I would read them a few chapters at a time, you know, to see if this was really something that kids liked.
So they were your focus group.
Yeah, and they liked it.
So did you, if you worked on it for 37 years, was this just stop and go, or did you...
Oh, a lot of stop and go. When I was on the farm, you know, we were homesteading there, and there was no time to sit around and write kids' books very much. But I carried the manuscript with me through many changes in many different households and places that I lived in. And the concept, as my mind expanded, the concept of the book expanded, you know, so I had to keep changing it and going back and putting more stuff in the beginning. And it's been quite a process, but I finally managed to tie up all the loose ends and get it in print.
Were there any parts that the kids told you to leave out?
No, not that I can remember. They seemed to like it all. And it seems to appeal to a wide age range of kids. Kids as young as 3 years old seemed to like it, and I thought that it might be a little bit old for a three-year-old, but I've had reports back from parents who were surprised also, and they read it to their older kids, but the three-year-old also liked it. And up through adult, you know. I tried to write something that, well, I'm an old-fashioned person, and I like to read to children. I don't think that's done very much anymore, but I hope there are still some parents out there that read to their kids, even when the kids are old enough to read for themselves. I think there's a special charm about having a story read to you, even if you're old enough to read yourself. And I read to my kids a lot, and I wanted to, and some books I couldn't stand, some kid books. And so I wanted to write something that the kids would enjoy, but that the grown-ups would also enjoy. So I tried to put in a little something for everybody.
Well, that leads to two more questions. First, what kids' books couldn't you stand?
Oh, well, gosh, I don't know if I even remember. Those are the ones I've forgotten about, I guess. But back when my kids were little, it was strictly old paradigm stuff, you know. I can't remember any of the details, but they were not the kind of things that I wanted to put into my kids' heads.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of liked the Narnia stories, but it was a little too only Christian for mm-hmm. me, and a little too old paradigm in terms of, you know, the ultimate success was to become royalty, you know, a king and queen is your reward. And I'm not into kings and queens.
And Lucy and Luke's reward is making it home in time for dinner.
Right.
So the other question is, if you've read it to small groups of kids and they've liked it, or if you read parts, have you considered a public reading?
Well, I'd be into doing that. I haven't thought very seriously about it or made any plans for it. I don't even know how I'd start trying to do that. Got any suggestions?
No, but you're in the place where there are lots of public venues, and we were just talking with Robert about the schoolhouse.
Actually, I have thought of something along those lines, not a full reading, but up here on the ridge we have Ridge Stop Cafe,
mm-hmm.
fairly new, and my books are for sale in there, by the way. And you can register for a month of an art exhibit there in the cafe and have some sort of an opening evening get together. And I thought maybe I would do one of those. I have posters that I've been making since 1993 here with pictures of my Ridge friends
mm-hmm.
on it. And I would like to put those up as my art exhibit and then have an evening where I could read a little from this book. And I'm working on a book of memoirs and would like to be able to read a little from that. And I have some poetry. And I thought I might, you know, try to get something like that together. But I don't have any kind of date set or anything like that.
Yeah. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Thome, and I've been talking with Sylvia Anderson about her kids' book for all ages, Symbolia. And you say it's available. It would be available at the Ridge Stop?
Yes, or on Amazon.com.
And then you also said that people can call you.
Right. My number is 292-3021. And if you want to call me, we'll figure out how to get a book to you. And also, the book has its own website, symboliabook.com, and you can order it there and read a little more about it.
Right. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on, Eric. It's been fun.
Okay, I agree.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Before I go, there's a couple of other things coming up I'd like to let you know about. The well-known, I would say, low-life author, Richard Price, although he's best known for his most recent novel, Lush Life, is going to be the next author at the California Lecture Series at the Crest Theater in Sacramento. He's going to be there at 7:30 p.m. on Thursday, March 12th, talking primarily, I think, about Lush Life, but he's one of those people who is known for his touch with dialogue and his ability to show you five or six imperfect sets of people, very sympathetically, all caught up in usually a horrible situation, a murder or a disappearance or something like that. So that's Richard Price. He'll be at the Cal Lecture Series on Thursday the 12th at 7:30. You can just go to californialectures.org to find out more. And also, in the couple of minutes before Jimmy Icardi comes on, I have a set of tickets for Greg Mortensen, who the author of Three Cups of Tea. That is this year's Nevada County Reads book. Unfortunately, he's not going to be able to come to Nevada County, but he will be at the City College of San Francisco at the Ocean Campus, the Diego Rivera Theater. We've got two tickets for that this Wednesday, the 4th, at 6 o'clock p.m. As soon as the music starts, which will be in almost instantly, I will take the first caller for those two tickets. So this has been Booktown. Stay tuned now for Jimmy Cardi's Rock and Roll Party.